Hello and welcome to another edition of the Duct Tape Marketing Podcast. This is your host, John Jantz, and my guest today is Phil Auerswald. He is an associate professor of public policy at George Mason University, a senior fellow at my hometown, Kauffman Foundation, and is also the co-founder and co-editor of Innovations, a journal about entrepreneurs and global challenges. And we're going to talk today about a really intriguing book that he has written about the coming prosperity and how entrepreneurs are transforming the global economy. So, Phil, thanks for joining me.
Hey, great to be on.
So I want to grab I always like to set the sort of foundation here and typically grab parts of subtitles to do that. So you talk about this thing, a transformation, and you talk about it as creating large-scale opportunities in countries like the United States, but also as having dramatic impact on really the rest of the world, particularly some of the sort of emerging world still. So you want to talk about what this transformation is and how it's going to do that?
Yeah, well, I mean, the backdrop for the book is the set of stories that we're used to hearing.
Right.
We can talk about financial crisis. We can talk about scarcity, resource scarcity issues, climate change. And here in the U.S., piled on top of that, political gridlock and, a sense of kind of powerlessness, in the face of all of these calamities, large and small. And there's obviously reality in all of that. There's no doubt that the last few years, have been difficult ones in the United States, and certainly the housing meltdown, has been a real phenomenon that's hit a lot of people. So that's the backdrop. The reason I wrote the book is because I think that there's a bigger story about our historical time period, about basically, our era, and that story isn't really getting out. I mean, the closest that we get is, sort of Fareed Zakaria and Tom Friedman, will talk about the rise of the rest. And so you've got, China, of course, is always a big story, and India and Brazil. And this particular version of the story that I'm telling is also one of kind of menace and threat, that previously poor countries are now becoming wealthy. They're kind of flexing their muscles, and that means that the role of the United States in Europe and Japan is diminished. So that gets a little bit closer, I think, to kind of understanding our historical time period. What I wanted to talk about in this book is that same sort of story about the global economy and the majority of the world's population who are now able to participate and a process of technological change and innovation that's been going back for four centuries, and tell it from the standpoint of opportunity. The premise here is pretty simple. I mean, when you have most people in the world finally able to create, communicate, collaborate with everybody else, particularly in the rich six of the world that has benefited from, as I said, the last four centuries of technological change and innovation, when most people in the world become part of this sort of global human collaborative body, good things should and will happen. We're seeing that already. So that's basically how it then becomes a book about entrepreneurship. The same sense of powerlessness that I talked about, that I just mentioned and alluded to, with regard to sort of political processes, again, misses the point. I mean, I think part of the issue with political processes is that they're increasingly peripheral to the amazing changes that are happening around the world. And those changes are being driven by individual initiative, by collaborative teams, by new technologies and transformations that we're seeing sort of all around us, but I think inadequately appreciating. So that's why the book's called The Coming Prosperity.
Well, and I think to take it to its most basic level so people can appreciate what you're talking about, I think you could look no farther than going on, say, like an Elance or something and look at the people that are, in some cases, working in a very cramped one bedroom place on top of a hotel in Delhi that are cranking out programming code, right?
Oh, totally. Yeah, I mean, you know, I'll tell you a brief anecdote, actually something that happened after I wrote the book, but I was on Twitter at a meeting one time. Somebody, a woman named Mona Abu Sulaiman, who's a graduate of George Mason University based in Saudi Arabia, she tweeted a story out about a young man, a 14-year-old Pakistani, who was the youngest person to have published in an IEEE journal. IEEE journal is the elite journal in electrical engineering. So, you know, obviously this is a very prestigious place to have your work published. So I retweeted this, and a few other people retweeted it. It's, you know, a nice story. And then I noticed that one of the people who retweeted it was this same young man, Babar Iqbal. And so I thought, well, that's neat. So he says, you know, thanks for retweeting my story. I said, hey, no problem. You know, it's really fantastic accomplishment. And then, you know, this went back and forth. And after a little while, he said, you know, I really like your journal, because he'd now been Googling me. And I said, well, thanks a lot. And then, you know, a couple more like that. And then he said, but, you know, I'm not really, I think your user interface is kind of weak. And so I said, well, you know, we're actually working on kind of upgrading our journal into the 21st century, and, you know, maybe this is something you'd like to be part of. So he's now, you know, part of this loose team that we've got, you know, multi-city, you know, team that's working on kind of upgrading Innovations Journal. And, you know, how likely would that have been, you know, even 10 years ago, much less 20 or 30, that first of all, Babar Iqbal would have had the opportunity to, you know, show his talents, publish in an IEEE journal, and that furthermore, within the space of minutes from halfway across the world, he's in Dubai now, that I would be able to, you know, recruit him to participate in a project that I'm working on. I mean, this is a completely different sort of reality, and these types of interactions are happening on a minute-by-minute basis.
Can you imagine, going back in history to, you know, all the names we studied in grade school about these great innovators and inventors and thought leaders who, you know, most of whom had died, you know, long before anybody really knew about their discoveries in some cases. And can you imagine if they'd had that kind of network to collaborate with now? You know, you're thinking the Einsteins and the Edisons of the world.
Well, you've totally hit it. I mean, this to me is exactly the basis for excitement about the future. It's really about the productive possibilities of people. And, you know, when we think about the totality of creative capability through human history, well, you know, those are the people who had the benefit of prosperity past. And so when I talk about prosperity, you know, I'm not talking about everybody owns 2-3 cars and so forth and so on. I'm talking about basic cognitive freedom. That's the world that we're entering into, where the majority of the world's population is at last having this experience of being able to spend some time to create, to envision, to invent. I mean, this has always been part of the human experience, but everybody who we think is the great inventors, the great creators of the past, comes out of a tiny slice of even all people who have lived in the past. So between the extension of human lifespans and this tremendous new capability, new population of creators that's now able to do exactly the things we've just been talking about. I mean, this is just unprecedented. And so we have all of those folks who had Einstein-like potential but died without ever going to school, much less being able to connect with somebody over Twitter, I mean, those folks are now going to be able to realize their potential. And they are partners, collaborators, customers. They are part of our future, and it's a great thing.
What role, and this might take us down a path we don't want to go necessarily, but what role should government play in either enabling this or getting out of the way of it, or you know, what's your thought on that? Because I could see, you know, a lot of times what slows innovation down is sort of the existing structure.
Well, you know, that's a big theme in the book, and this is something that that I'm, you know, certainly not the first person to articulate. You have the same insight. I mean, going back as an economist, really the person in economics who told that story of basically how incumbent interests are an obstacle to innovation was a gentleman named Joseph Schumpeter, who was economist of Austrian origin, ended up at Harvard in the 1930s, wrote a book called The Theory of Economic Development, which remains the best book about the role of entrepreneurs in the process of development, and that book was written 100 years ago. And in that and in later work, what Schumpeter really talked about was how incumbent interests come about very naturally in the process of the functioning of a capitalist economy. I mean, when you have competition, particularly when you have economies of scale, so when companies benefit from being bigger and can produce products at a lower cost, potentially a higher quality by virtue of size, then at a certain point you have this kind of capture of industries by the big dominant corporates. And so Schumpeter was worried about this back in the 1920s. And, you know, it turned out that we've had certainly a lot of economic dynamism between the 1920s and today. And so to that extent, it appears, you know, maybe his worst fears didn't come true. But, you know, whether we talk about it, I'm just going to focus on the United States, but this is even more true in other parts of the world. But our energy infrastructure, our healthcare infrastructure, our educational infrastructure, and our financial services infrastructure, these are all built around companies that are very well organized to defend their interests. So the first thing that individual citizens can do, and government, those enlightened people in government, wherever they may be, can also do when they have the latitude to do it, is act to favor incumbents less. Incumbents will always be at the table to advocate for their piece, their continuing significant piece of whatever pie society bakes, and it is absolutely imperative that government act to favor incumbents less. And that doesn't necessarily mean, that's not necessarily the same thing as stay out of the way. You know, staying out of the way can be really a way to favor incumbents more. And so it's a nuanced sort of point, but basically when government policies work to reinforce the interests of incumbent institutions and organizations and companies, then you don't have the kind of entrepreneurial entry and innovation that's potentially, that's possible.
Well, that's interesting too, because it sort of runs counter to the reality. I mean, a lot of times it's just the rich get richer because, you know, they get more entrenched.
Yeah, well, you know, but the thing that works against that is technology.
Yep.
And this is why it's not that the technology is the panacea and solves every problem. The greatest thing that technology and entrepreneurship does is to create a space for the future. I mean, entrepreneurs, determined entrepreneurs, who have new technologies to work with. I mean, these are the people we all know through history, people who just will not be denied their chance. And, you know, that's why this is a book about entrepreneurship and prosperity. Entrepreneurship is fabulous because it creates jobs, because entrepreneurs bring new technologies into market, but it's even more fabulous because entrepreneurs are the people more than anybody else in society who are able to challenge incumbent interests, create new market spaces, and create opportunities for people who've been excluded, as well as for those who already have opportunities. I mean, it's the whole package, right? We know what entrepreneurship is about. So that's to me, you know, a central part of the story I'm trying to tell in this book, is the complete story of what entrepreneurs do to advance society.
I was I got the opportunity to speak this weekend at the American Library Association's annual conference out in Anaheim, and one of the things that I was talking to this group about was, you know, one of their charges, of course, from a marketing standpoint, is to reach those that don't have access, that some of the lower socioeconomic areas that can get books, but also give them, you know, they get technology, they get access to digital things that the library now has, and one of the challenges that they find is in reaching those folks. And one of the things I push them towards pretty hard is you reach those folks through the mobile device. And I think that people are starting to realize that it almost doesn't matter what circumstance you are in life. people are acquiring the mobile devices and the smartphones, which obviously basically makes them, you know, a communication tool, an access tool as well. And I was really thrilled to see you talking about the idea that the impact of the mobile device may be even bigger than what we've experienced in the internet in general.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's already much bigger. The reach of mobile phones is well beyond the internet globally. And in a shorter time period, obviously, the internet sort of came into being before mobile devices. So, when something's right in front of our faces, it's easy to take it for granted. In the U.S., I mean, in the just 15 years ago, only 1 in 100 people in the United States used a mobile phone. Now it's so embedded in our lives, that we sort of can't imagine functioning without it. But in the U.S., we already have a lot of, goods and services, infrastructure of different types. So there's a tremendous convenience around mobile phones, but there's a sense of, also a kind of a triviality, time sink. People complain about, all the different ways in which mobile phones intrude. That's much less true in other parts of the world, where mobile phones essentially are the highway of the future. They are a virtual highway, and if you think just by analogy to, I talk about actually, the transcontinental railroad as kind of the metaphor. But whether you want to call it railroads or highways, either way, whenever there is a new infrastructure like that, and what it creates is not just an opportunity for people to use that infrastructure for transportation, or in the case of mobile phones, for communication, it's all the services you build on the side of the road, right? I mean, this is, whether you see Rango or, any other movie about, about the opportunity, the market opportunities that the railways created, it was about owning the land on either side of the road. And that land is this virtual territory on either side of the this global telecommunications infrastructure we're building is the provision of health services, provision of financial services. I mean, a place like Pakistan, only about 15% of the people have any sort of access to the financial system, have a bank account, any kind of connection to the financial system. So, this is a country of 180 million people where 85% of those people are unbanked. That's a big market opportunity, and it's going to be a market opportunity where success is going to be improving the lives of millions of people. And that's just one example. There's similar, equally exciting opportunities in the delivery of health services, sort of diagnostics, even actual care through mobile devices. So the fact that we have this mobile technology that's the fastest growing, most widely diffused technology in human history. Only the transistor radio and previous experience competes really in terms of its reach to the village level. And before that, a colleague of mine has said, I think he's right, it's pretty much fire is the last example, that has that kind of power. So I personally think just if we look at the technologies already in use, the potentials are incredible. And that's not even, taking into account, obviously, things that will be coming down the pike.
So let's end this on a little bit of a sort of an advice piece, if you want to give some. So I'm talking to Phil Oswald. The coming prosperity is what we're talking about, how entrepreneurs are transforming the global economy. So just from an advice standpoint, if I'm an entrepreneur or a would-be entrepreneur, what some advice for how I might start plugging into this, tapping this, looking for opportunities?
Well, I wanted to end with some specific words of guidance without, pretending to lay out some sort of recipe or plan that I don't believe exists in the kind of complex world that we live in. But I think at the end of the day, people do want to know, okay, well, so how do I turn this into action? And the best I could come up with was sort of a four-step process. I mean, the first step, folks listening to this podcast already doing, I'm sure, to connect. I mean, you need to be part of something. And you need to connect using all the tools at our disposal. So that's not just mobile. That's not just using your phone. Obviously, it's social networking, all this. These are powerful tools. Certainly, they can be used trivially, but the tools of connection we have are really powerful tools. And the next is to create. And so once you've connected, you got to bring something to the table. And creating helps you kind of define yourself in a community. So when we think about an open source community, Linux, old story, right? The first part is just to kind of sign up to write some code, and then the next is just to bring something. And so it's the third step is contribute. I mean, once you've created something, then you really try to contribute. And I think open source is a great metaphor, even for a for-profit company. That you want to then, once you've kind of situated yourself, find something tangible that you can contribute that can sort of define you professionally. And the end point is collaboration. organization. I mean, you know, entrepreneurship is a collaborative process. It's a team building process, and contributing to a sort of more or less, you know, anonymous open source community is very different from finding somebody else in that community who you want to start a company with. I mean, that's a big commitment, and collaboration is a big commitment. It doesn't have to be a kind of a lifelong company building process. It could be more like the movie industry, you know, more like a posse. You know, you kind of get together around a certain project, drive it hard, and then move on to the next one. But I think that this, you know, this process of connect, create, contribute, collaborate, and then you iterate that. I mean, this is the work life for everybody. It's not just you know, entrepreneurs or folks who are self-employed. If you work in a big company and you're not have this mindset that you are a free agent, you are always building relationships, you are always looking for the next opportunities to do these four things, then whenever your contract comes to an end with whatever you know, comfortable company you happen to be in, you're not going to have that habit that enables you to be a successful 21st century contributor. So you know, I think that it's, but it starts with connection, and it starts with connection across whatever boundaries are going to be most valuable to you. So professional boundaries, geographical boundaries, and then moving on from there.
Yeah, and I have four 20-something daughters, and I really see that mindset sort of pervasive in that age group. I mean, I don't think they have any delusion that they're going to go to work for some company forever, that it's really all about kind of this, you know, Dan Pink's sort of free agent, you know, idea.
Yep. Yeah. Well, I mean, and I had a friend of mine in Arlington, Massachusetts, who wrote a book 20 years ago called We Are All Self-Employed. And, you know, I mean, I think it's a theme that has just taken a long time to develop. And now we're all there. Like, yeah. Everybody's there. Yeah. And anybody who's not gotten that memo is just in serious trouble.
Yeah. Awesome. Phil, thanks so much for joining me. I know well, you've got the summer off, right? You're not teaching any.
Well, I am. No, I'm teaching an online, online course on entrepreneurship and globalization based on my course. We've got 800 students signed up from
awesome.
Over 50 countries. So
that's awesome.
It's really been really exciting. Yeah, Ashoka U Online.
Where can people find more about the book, about your work, maybe even about that course?
Well, the about the book, thecomingprosperity.com will take you to my website, also ourswald.org, just my last name, .org. And then about the course, you know, all of the interviews we've had, you know, and readings and so forth and so on are at www.ashokau.org/online.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Phil, so much. And if you make it back to Kansas City and visit any of the fine folks there, hopefully we can connect in person.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot for having me on. It's been a lot of fun. Bye.